Today on Future Tense, the research professor, the neo-Luddite, and the technological anthropologist. And no, that's not the beginning of a joke. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Over the next half hour or so, I want to introduce you to three very different individuals, each with the desire to make a better future. Cultural anthropologist Genevieve Bell, who heads up the user experience group at Intel and is a current thinker in residence in South Australia. Professor Peter Hodson from Deakin University, who'll talk about our attitudes toward research, and the internationally renowned Australian poet John Kinsella, who maintains that technology isn't the deliverance of humanity, it's our damnation.
Technology is said to make our lives more comfortable and more interesting and safer and more productive. Well, I actually don't believe that's true. I believe that these kind of enhanced technologies, maybe that's the word I want, enhanced technologies are actually depriving us of our liberty, are actually encroaching on our health, encroaching on our mental and physical freedoms.
Okay, our first guest, Dr. Genevieve Bell, is an Australian who lives in the United States. And she's just finishing up a term as a thinker in residence in South Australia, as I mentioned earlier. Now, her field of interest as an anthropologist is in the importance of culture in the adoption and adaption of technology, a theme which we've touched on quite a bit in recent programs. When she's in the States, she works for Intel Corporation, the giant technology company, and she's their director of user experience. So let's find out what that means.
When Intel hired me 10 years ago, it was a period when personal computers were first moving out of offices and into people's homes in real numbers. And I think there was a great deal of concern in the technology industry broadly and at Intel specifically about what was going to happen to those PCs when they got into people's homes. And part of the company's response to that was to hire a range of different kinds of social scientists, anthropologists, but also cognitive psychologists, to really try and get a sense of what people were going to do with those computers. And over the last 10 years, I think Intel's interest in what people would do with those computers has morphed from a challenge about, oh God, we don't know what's going to happen, to if we actually work out what people care about and what they value, we can use that as a starting point for innovating new technology. And really, that's mostly what my role is today. I'm responsible for helping Intel think about what future uses and usages of technology might be, specifically in the consumer electronics realm.
Now, corporations like Intel are primarily motivated by profit. What do you get out of this, though? As a cultural anthropologist, I presume you're interested more than just scouting out new potential markets for Intel products.
No, absolutely. Clearly, one of the reasons that's kept me at Intel and one of the reasons that's kept me committed to this kind of work is the opportunity to develop technology that matters. I think one of the big transitions that companies in the technology industry, both in mobile phones and other technologies, have really gone through in the last 10 or 15 years is to start to have to build technology that really speaks to people. It's not enough anymore that it be shiny and flashy and have blinky lights and be the latest, coolest thing. It also has to do something people care about. And for me, getting that right, creating technology that matters, creating a company that thinks about where their technology might end up and who cares about the consequences was really important for me.
Is this an ongoing battle? I mean, in a sense, do you have to keep reminding, corporations, people in corporations, to look at the human component? You know, is that often forgotten of when they're talking about technological development?
I think one of the things I'm most proud of in my tenure at Intel has been changing the shape of the conversation. I think when I joined Intel, it was quite common to say, I've built this thing, now tell me how to sell it, which was the first point at which users really came into the conversation. And I think one of the transitions my colleagues and I have really helped shepherd at Intel is one that moved from, here's the thing, now how do we sell it, to what's the experience we want to enable? And then let's think about what technology makes that possible. And of course, it's always an ongoing battle. And I think that's not surprising. There's always a tension between needing to get something into the marketplace, needing to be profitable, needing to make technological breakthroughs, but also do things that are satisfying.
Now, you've just spent time on a field trip in rural South Australia. Could you tell us about that?
This has been one of the great pleasures of my life recently. So for the last 6 months, but really the last two in particular, I have been South Australia's 15th Thinker in Residence, which is a program started by Premier Rann about 4 or 5 years ago, designed to bring out-of-the-box thinkers from outside Australia back into Australia, and specifically into South Australia, to help address the problems and critical concerns and issues for the state moving forward. And I was asked to come and help think about what the future of technology might be for South Australia. And for me, answering that question involves spending my time doing fieldwork and talking to people in South Australia. I think I clocked about 13,000 kilometres in 6 weeks. I visited 45 different communities ranging in size from the five people in William Creek to many people in places like Adelaide, but also in Port Augusta, Whyalla, Ceduna, Murray Bridge, Berry, Loxton, Renmark, Cooper Pedy, Woomera, the APY lands, and last but by no means least, places like Andamooka and Tarawi and Oruru.
And what were you looking for in terms of that sort of assessment of their technology?
Well, I was always looking for a good pie shop and a decent cup of coffee. And once I got past those sort of immediate needs, I was really trying to get a sense of what it was that people were doing in their lives with technology. And it became increasingly clear as I worked through this project that asking people about the technology in their lives was really just about asking them about their lives. And this project took place against the backdrop of a global economic crisis that's had real impact in South Australia and a drought that is increasingly impacting lives across the state. So people were very concerned about their futures, worried about their families and their communities and their kids and their businesses. And really talking about technology meant talking about all of those things.
I guess in one sense we have a tendency to look for commonalities in communities, and that's probably a good thing for the most part. But from the field trips that you've done over the years, not just here in Australia but elsewhere, how much difference is there in the way that people view and use new technology?
There are some remarkable differences globally about people's relationships to technology, and it's not just about the way they use them, it's about the way they think about them. It's about the way they respond to them emotionally. It's even about the kind of conceptual frameworks they have for making sense of those technologies. So even within South Australia, I've been really struck by these two kind of very different conceptual models that people have about their relationships to technology. I've talked to a number of people who refer to things like Twitter and Flickr and YouTube and MySpace and Facebook and Bebo and their even old-fashioned email accounts as their vital signs, and talk about needing to check them regularly. This kind of, I need to just check my vital signs, sort of to know that they're still ticking over in the world. I've also run across a whole different group of people who, exemplified by one wonderful man down in Malang on the Lower Lakes in South Australia, who said to me, he said, sometimes it just feels like life's overheads are increasing. He meant that he now has to balance more bills and more devices and more services and plans and information that's on different devices that don't speak to each other. And I was really struck by the fact that even in a small state like South Australia, small in terms of population, there were two very different ways of thinking about the relationship between oneself and technology. And I think when you start to expand the lens and move globally, you find an even wider range of different kinds of ways that we relate to and make sense of technology.
How will the information that you've gathered there, I mean, how will that type of information feed back to what you're doing in Intel?
Well, in a couple of ways. One, it's been a long time since I've had 2 months to do fieldwork, so I've had a chance to try out some new research methods, and I think I will take some of those back now that I know the ones that work and don't. We certainly, on this project, it was the first time I've tried to use social networking technology, so Web 2.0 tools in particular, as a research tool. I ran a blog soliciting feedback from South Australians and stories about their relationships with technology. And that's actually been a surprisingly nice research tool. People have given all kinds of feedback. We have continued to have dialogues online. And I'll certainly think about how I incorporate that back into my research at Intel. And I think insofar as one of the things that became very clear to me in this trip has been about the reliability and robustness of technology, I go back emboldened to have to raise that question one more time. I think I've just been incredibly struck as I've spent my time both actually in Adelaide and around the state by the fact that the biggest problem with technology is technology itself. It's in some ways not well designed to be in our living rooms and our sheds and our cars and our backpacks and our schools. and that the frailties of it continue to impede our successes. And that we have a long way to go in terms of either creating technology that's robust enough that it never needs to be repaired, or capability building so that we have people who know how to repair it. And I know the piece of that equation I can help solve.
Well, Dr. Genevieve Bell, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And if you want to find out more about South Australia's Thinker in Residence program, just go to our website and click on the link. Guest number two lives in Perth, describes himself as an anarchist and possibly a neo-Luddite, though he's strictly a pacifist. He also happens to be one of Australia's finest poets. He's a fellow of Churchill College at Cambridge University and a member of the academic staff at the University of Western Australia. Now, unlike Genevieve Bell, who clearly believes in the power of technology to change people's lives for the better, John Kinsella sees modern technology as potentially ruinous. Computers, he says, aren't a tool of liberation, but of destruction. It's not a commonly held view, and that's why we've got him on the program.
We very much live in a time, certainly in the wealthy West, where technology is seen as a panacea, a thing in itself. I want to qualify the word technology here, you know, using a pair of scissors. Now, yes, a pair of scissors are a form of technology. To me, a pair of scissors are a very functional and pretty well non-damaging form of technology, and one that, you know, I would basically approve of. It takes a bit of manual labour to use them. It doesn't kind of destroy a vast amount of the planet in the process of doing so. You can get the metal in relatively low-impact ways, the amount of metal it would take, and so on and so on. There's a kind of series of connections, degrees of non-separation, if you like, that make it a viable technology. On the other hand, a machine that involves nanotechnology and utilizes, you know, very, very complex and sophisticated materials that require certain kinds of mining that are immensely damaging and so on, to cut a piece of tin or cut a piece of paper or cut anything for that matter, it goes into a different category. So when I use the word technology, I don't mean it in terms of something that assists human activity. I mean technology that goes beyond its need, to my mind at least.
And you're damning of modern information communication technology, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been using it for a long time. I started using and making computers when I was a teenager back in the 70s and the mid-70s. And I used the earliest personal computers that sort of were ever on the market. I used them in a laboratory where I worked during my school holidays at a place called Nungaloo outside Geraldton. And so I was very familiar with these technologies. I learned computer languages. I used the first computer I think ever installed, certainly in a Western Australian school, but possibly in an Australian school. My point is that I believe that there are we've got to an unnecessary level of materialist, consumerist kind of usage. Why do you need to go further than that? Why do you keep needing to push the envelope? What is the end result of it all? Well, technology is said to make our lives more comfortable and more interesting and safer and more productive. Well, I actually don't believe that's true. I believe that these kind of enhanced technologies, maybe that's the word I want, enhanced technologies are actually depriving us of our liberty, are actually encroaching on our health, encroaching on our mental and physical freedom.
Now, picking up on that, I mean, that goes against, I suppose, what we hear all the time, the sort of link made between modern technology and progress, that it is always good to have a newer form of some technology. I mean, that seems to be at the core of your concern.
It is, and I don't think that's... I think some technologies, you know, reach their most efficient point, not only most efficient in terms of usage, but most efficient in terms of a balance, if you like, with the environment around the use of that technology. Well, the catchword is sustainable. It's not a word I like. I think sustainable is loaded with all sorts of problematical politics. I've written essays on this and so on, and there are all sorts of issues around that word sustainable. In the end, it's a catchphrase, and anything that's being used as a kind of, you know, a soundbite is problematical. But all the same, I do think technologies reach a point where they're viable and they are sustainable. But many technologies get beyond that point, and also the kind of impacts are not registered at first glance. You take, for example, video games. When I was a kid, they started appearing with the, you know, the tennis ping pong effect. You move the bat up and down on either side of the screen and you knock the dot from one side to the other. Very basic technology. As they became increasingly sophisticated, you got, you know, extreme graphics that introduced, you know, all sorts of possibilities of illustrating, you know, violence and so on and so on. The technology started to enhance a different kind of mental process where reality ceased to be sort of relevant. Now, that's okay. I'm a writer. I'm dealing with reality and non-reality all the time. I have no problem with pushing the imagination as far as possible. I'm also not a censor. I don't believe in extreme censorship or anything like that either. It's not an issue of that. It's an issue of actually causing someone to be unable, leading to a situation where they're unable to connect with the kind of sad realities that are happening out there, outside their door, A, of violence, and B, of destruction, and so on. It becomes almost an insulation.
So in our thirst, in a sense, for new technologies, you know, perhaps you might even describe it as a fadism with technology, with new forms of technology, are we, in a sense, not facing up to our responsibilities to the environment?
I mean, I think absolutely.
We don't really talk about that very much, do we? The effect that computers have, the amount of energy they drain, that sort of thing.
Well, this is it. And these are facts, you know. They really do. The resources they drain in the direct sense of, you know, being plugged into the grid and so on, and using the materials that make the electricity. Well, that's an obvious sense, but people forget about the actual machinery itself, the hardware itself. All the materials that go in, some of these materials are highly toxic and highly damaging materials. Now, you're getting the new generation of so-called green computers, but they're only relatively green. I mean, if you actually look into them, the basic materials are still the same. They have a few differences. They may not include a few examples of the, less examples of the extreme toxicity or the extreme toxic materials, but still, in essence, they're still consuming and using a massive amount of materials. The other thing about computers is that they are a faddish technology in the sense that they constantly are upgraded and constantly change, and we constantly feel a need to improve our own technologies to do more things. So it's not like you go and buy a computer and you sit on it for 30 years and that's a wise usage of that material. It's that, you know, 5 years later, your computer really doesn't work very well. It doesn't actually function in the way it used to function. It's not adequate, if you like. And that is faddish, and that's just basic consumerism and the whole kind of capitalist urge. And, you know, I'm not just talking about Western capitalism. I'm talking about sort of capitalism in its, single state versions, communist China, so on and so on. That's still a capitalist nation in every functional economic way. The drive to create a market that wants your product so you can sell it and make money, and that old classic, you know, Marxist issue of the fetishization. You know, you're actually increasing the worth of something well beyond its actual worth because you need to sell to the profit so the middle person or the middle people can profit as well. I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. It's just you look at what we've got and you see it just being consumed for the sake of a faddish and fetishistic, you know, process.
Now, you've taken the decision to go largely offline at the end of this year.
Yep.
As a poet who travels a lot, who's in demand in various countries, what sort of effect is that going to have on your professional life?
Oh, well, it's had a dramatic effect already. I lived in three countries for, 15 years. I'm still a fellow at Churchill College at Cambridge University. I taught in the Midwest in America and had a position in Australia. And I moved between those different, you know, institutions consistently. You know, 1 year I flew upwards 900 hours in a year. And I mean, that's more than pilots are basically allowed to fly for, you know, in terms of radiation exposure and all the other issues. And that's how I led a life, you know. And I came to a decision halfway through last year. I think the last time I flew was mid-year last year, or maybe a bit later than that, and I thought, I've got to give up flying. Here I am, going around the world proselytizing about the sort of susceptibility and vulnerability of environments around the world, and here I am flying, using not only fuel, but in vehicles that create these contrails, which are very problematical, and a whole other series of associated issues around flying. I've got to stop. So I did, and I haven't flown since. I will never fly again. The only thing that would ever induce me to fly is if, you know, someone was literally dying and I had to be there. Even then, I'd try every other way. But I, in essence, have entirely and absolutely given up flying. That's not to say that I think I'm not trying to impose an agenda on other people. I don't work like that. I don't try and make people be what I am. What I try and do is say, look, this is an alternative way of existing. So what I'm doing instead, I still have to get to other places. I now travel by train in Australia. I've been across on the Indian Pacific a few times in the last year to the eastern states. next time I go to Europe will be by boat. I'm going by freighter. Now, you know, they also consume vast amounts of fuel and so on, but much less in terms of the person on it and so on. I've investigated that carefully, and I'll go overland wherever possible, so on trains and so on. It does use less resources. More people can be taken in that way, all sorts of things. It's a complex issue that I've looked into carefully. But the other thing is, it's, of course, very time-consuming. So I'm going to do it once every few years rather than 5 times a year or 10 times a year, just because you physically couldn't. And you come into contact with place and you see what's going on far more, obviously, directly if you're going through it on surface rather than flying over it. And I think that has an impact on the way you see it. And that can only be a good thing. So I'm substantially changing my life. Once upon a time when I was young, I lived in communes down south, as they do, and so on, and you know, had my dreadlocks and the whole bit, and lived a very alternative life. No electricity at all, no running water or tanks or from streams, except they got polluted, that kind of thing. And I'm trying to go back to that, but in a way that I have a family, that allows me to actually still make a living, and it allows me to interact with people, but to be as low impact as possible. As I call it, basically a neo-Luddite. I'm not interested in destroying things like the Luddites did with the looms and so on, but I'm interested in setting up an alternative example, especially for people who read my work and so on. You know, I'm making my own paper, that kind of thing, and looking into alternative ways of doing things that are actually functional and practical.
And from Berlin to Brisbane, this is Future Tense on ABC Online, ABC Radio National and Radio Australia.
And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter, where our name is RN Future Tense, all one word. And now for guest number 3. Peter Hodson lives in Geelong in Victoria and enjoys robotics, the biosciences and working with lightweight metals. He's the Director of Research at Deakin University's Institute for Technological Research Innovation. And earlier this week, he was one of 15 scholars presented with an Australian Laureate Fellowship by Australia's Science Minister Kim Carr. Now, at the ceremony, he spoke about research in Australia, the way in which we value it and how we should promote it. Peter Hodson.
The Laureate Fellows themselves, I guess, are trying to attract back to Australia or people who have left, also trying to keep people here who could easily go overseas. And so I guess they're funding for sort of real international excellence. And it's very critical, really, to have that sort of almost a tall poppy thing, you know, to have fellowships or centres of excellence, etc., which recognise where we are very strong. In my case, for example, getting the Federation Fellowship before the Laureate Fellowship really led to quite a significant improvement in the quality of people that were actually applying to come and do PhDs with me or work with me. And so that's obviously very good for my own research, but also very good for that sort of field in Australia.
So there is a direct correlation, if you like, between the provision of grants for research and also the recognition that comes with those, the top-level grants, and the number of young scientists who are interested or who want to stay in the research field?
That's right, yes. And so these sort of, I guess, premier grants do attract, you know, quite a lot of attention. And I think we have some good funding for the people starting out in research. Where there's a real gap at the moment in Australia is in between period, when you're no longer what we call an early career researcher and you're going through the stages of becoming maybe a professor, that area, it's very difficult to get funding to do your research. And so that's, to me, one of the issues in the current funding structure at the moment. We have the top end probably right. We're doing a bit down the new end. But for the people who have been in the game, say, for 10 to 20 years and are still moving up, it's becoming harder and harder to get the sort of funding you need to keep your research going.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think, obviously, the public understands health-related research very well. They understand certain bits of engineering, maybe. But the research in lots of other fields that needs to be done doesn't really get great public and hence government attention. If researchers think they're in the game to get a grant, if they think they're getting close to in terms of their CV and the work they've already done, they'll go that extra yard, they'll work really longer hours, trying to do more just to get themselves over the line. If they think it's very, very difficult to get a grant, then they tend to be a little bit disillusioned and turn off. And as I said before, with all the pressures of teaching and administration, etc., you can actually see it, their research sort of starts to stagnate a little bit. And so I would like to see more funding, particularly in the ARC Discovery Scheme, to try and, I guess, get more people actively engaged in thinking about international quality research.
That's the Australian Research Council, the ARC.
That's right, yes, sorry, yes.
Another thing that came across in your speech this week was the idea of valuing what you call personal intuition and not just, as you say, linear thinking. Explain what you mean by that.
You know, I work with a lot of groups around the world, and you see the sort of leaders in a lot of these groups now that, if we go back, say, 20 or 30 years ago, when I guess the problems were simpler, they were more, you know, we want to solve this equation or we want to build this material. The problems are much more complex now, and they often require combinations of ideas. And what I'm seeing myself is that the research leaders are not necessarily the narrow bookworm type people. They're people who actually think quite creatively and can take an idea from this field or this area and pull it into the area they're working in. Also, these sort of creative people then tend to work out how to get the best out of their team. They might say, well, this person's really good at doing this sort of research, this person can do that. And through this whole sort of team approach and their leadership, they can actually go ahead much more quickly. And I think Australia is very good at that. I think that our researchers here are very creative and very intuitive. And if you're going in a linear way, it'll take you a long time to get to the answer, whereas you can sort of do a jump here and a jump there, you can get there much quicker. But, I mean, also, the other thing to remember is that in a university, we're actually doing research training. So the PhD student and the postdoctoral fellows working with a professor are as much there to learn about the processes of research as to get an outcome. And again, I sort of worry sometimes that we get too driven on, you know, what's the tangible outcome as opposed to what processes other people learning.
We often hear of the importance of research having what's called a real-world focus. And that's often read by the more cynical amongst us, I guess, as meaning it needs to be private sector focused. What's your view?
I think the real key is actually to be balanced. And I think that if I was to say anything about what we're doing in the group in Geelong is that we've really taken a look at it and said, well, I mean, I've got a steel background, my colleague's got a textiles background, you know, very down-to-earth sort of here-and-now type materials. So you obviously need to be connected to industry to understand their issues so you're doing relevant research. But at the same time, both of us are looking at nanotechnology, as an example, and saying, well, what concepts or what tools can we take from nanotechnology and apply them to our materials? Because if we're not doing that sort of discovery research, then in 5 years' time, we'll have used up all the knowledge that we have because we've been applying it. We won't have that next generation of knowledge to apply. I mean, just to give an example, this before I came here, I had a physicist, a mechanical engineer, myself, and a chemist, another metallurgist, and we were discussing solar energy and whether we, with our unique skill set of manufacturing and material science, etc., could do something in solar energy. Now, there's a lot more thinking to be done, but by having this group of people who get on really well together and sort of putting this difficult problem on the table, we actually started within about an hour to come up with some areas where we thought we could make a contribution. We're not going to build a silicon solar cell, but there are things that we do which could actually add to some of that sort of solar technology.
Now, we had West Australian Professor John Hullett on the program last week, and he talked about a continuing cultural cringe, as he said, in Australia when it comes to appreciating our technological achievements. Is that something that you can relate to?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's very difficult, really, to get the sort of level of industry funding that we do need to do. I mean, if you're in Europe, you get industry funding, but it would be to do more blue sky research, whereas here, if we get industry funding, it's quite sort of, you know, here and now. If they want to get something really new, they'll probably look overseas rather than looking inside Australia. And even these laureate fellows, for example, there's been a lot of debate. You know, should we have such an elite level of professor, shall we say? You know, it's almost un-Australian. So there is this sort of, you know, trying to norm things back to being, well, you know, we're fairly good, etc. But, you know, I think that we do have to sort of, you know, push our excellence. And we sort of have to somehow or other, I don't know how, because I'm still struggling, convince industry, not so much government, because government actually does fund this sort of research, but to convince industry to take more risks in its research portfolio.
Professor Peter Hodson from the Institute for Technological Research Innovation at Deakin University. And that's it from us for another week. My co-producer is Andrew Davies, technical assistance by Jim Usher. Next week, tribes and communities, social groupings in the 21st century. This is ABC Radio National, and I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks for joining me.
Graphic images are emerging of bloody and
Iran's foreign minister is accusing the US and Britain of interfering in the election and its aftermath.
Why do the Iranian leadership accuse Britain and America of fomenting the current unrest in Tehran?
In 1953, the CIA joined British agents to help overthrow Iran's then prime minister.
It's a story about oil, democracy and a CIA coup. That's Rear Vision. You can download this program from the Radio National website.